From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. If you're a black man who happens to be a star athlete or musician, you're bound to get a lot of exposure. But many African American men and boys are still struggling to live a more modest version of the American dream. A Columbia University professor found that a majority of black male teens don't finish high school. Less than 1 in 5 go to college while they're between the ages of 18 and 21. Some say the legacy of slavery created a structural racism that still makes it hard for black men and boys to get a fair shot. For years, churches, schools, civil rights groups, and foundations have offered young men opportunities. Now a high-visibility player has joined in. George Soros's Open Society Institute announced the Campaign for Black Male Achievement last week. Sean Dove heads that campaign, and he joins us now. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Farai. How are you?
I'm great. So give me a sense of whether or not things are getting better or worse for young black men and boys.
Well, they certainly are getting worse, Farai. And what compounds it is that in this age of information and instant access to information and research, what the greater country is understanding and finally realizing is something that we have known in the black community for some time, that our boys and men are at peril, and that conditions have not gotten better when in the greater American society in different races we've seen advances in economic upturn.
Now, who are we seeing who's new on the scene in terms of trying to do outreach? I mean, we've seen at different points schools doing mentoring programs, civil rights activists doing mentoring. Who are we seeing sort of stepping into the breach now?
I think what we're seeing, Farai, is a number of private philanthropic organizations, foundations, who have implicitly helped black men and boys through their grant making over the years, begin to decide that they want to create targeted grant making strategies to support African American men and boys. So we're seeing organizations like the Ford Foundation, the Schott Foundation for Public Education, 21st Century Foundation, of course, the Open Society Institute, Charles Hayden Foundation. There are a number of foundations that are looking at this issue and are directing resources and strategies for direct service, advocacy, and policy work.
The Open Society Institute has done a number of things, but one of those has been to focus on international democracy. Why? This seems in some ways like a little bit of a left turn for the foundation. Why was this important?
Well, I wouldn't say that's a left turn. When you look at the values and principles of the Open Society, I think it's clear that as an organization and what we stand for, we could not stand by and not do anything with this issue. When you look at black men and boys, we are at the bottom of every social, educational, economic indicator. And so what we're doing with the Black Male Achievement, the Campaign for Black Male Achievement, this is really in line with our principles and our mission.
We've seen Senator Barack Obama talk recently about fatherhood, and that's something that we're going to talk about a little bit later with our next guest. But how does the issue of fatherhood, who's at home, who's in contact, who's mentoring within the family, affect black boys particularly?
I think the whole notion of fatherhood is really at one of the issues that are at the heart of what we are seeing in our community. When fathers are in prison, when fathers are unable to seek and gain employment and are able to be leaders in their community, that certainly has a direct, if not trickle-down effect on the growth and development of young people. Our country is made up of a bunch of communities, and communities are made up of families. And if we are looking at African-American families where 7 out of 10 children are born out of wedlock or without a father in the home, that's going to have a serious negative impact on the stability of the families and the growth and stability of the community.
How do you deal with the question of save the parent, to heck with the child? That's been a criticism of some programs where it's like, you know, we're going to, you know, focus on the fathers. We're not going to focus on the kids, or the reverse in some programs. We're going to focus on the kids, not the fathers. Do you try to integrate this approach?
I think to reverse the issues and negative outcomes, there has to be a holistic strategy. we cannot address the issues and problems of mother and child in a vacuum or father in a vacuum. There has to be an interdisciplinary approach that we are building and working and responding to the needs of the entire family, whether the father is in the home or not, whether the father is just released from prison and is he getting the reentry services and job training placement that he needs, because that impacts directly on how he is able to provide for and support for his children.
Well, Sean, thanks so much. Sean Dove heads the Open Society Institute's campaign for Black male achievement. He joined us from our NPR New York Bureau, and we've heard about one major foundation's efforts to impact the lives of Black boys and young men. Now we go to the trenches. Cornelius Ellen is a project coordinator for the Grand Boulevard Federation. That's a community-based organization serving at-risk youth in Chicago. Welcome, Cornelius.
Thank you for having me.
So we just talked a little bit with Sean Dove of the Open Society Institute. Do you think big foundations in general to this date have stepped up to try to coordinate with grassroots organizations?
Yes, they've stepped up, but it's a matter of, is the funding going to be top-heavy? Is it going to go to the organizers like myself, or is it going to actually the money going to reach the youth or the initiatives that these projects have?
Let's talk a little bit about your work. What exactly does the Grand Avenue Federation do?
Grand Boulevard? We have a lot of different programs. We have an asthma health program. We have Safety Networks for the community that addresses the older Black men and boys from who are out of high school and who are young adults who still need guidance. We also have a positive youth development initiative and also my initiative, which specifically works with lower performing high school and feeder school and elementary school.
Give me an example of how one of the students that you work with has reacted to the work that you do, maybe been has changed his life expectations.
I think one student who was very good at athletics just expected to be good at basketball and then expect to go to a big college, like, say, a UCLA or something like that. Well, I had to stress to him that still you have to qualify academically for some of these schools, you know, and he had to get his act together. And I made sure that he was completing his assignments before practice, turning in assignments on time, making it to school on time. He wasn't the only project. I just put him together with a lot of other students, and we made it a requirement for our athletic program, our student athletes, to meet an hour before practice to do their homework and everything.
Now, you have three children. Two of them are boys, and so how do you use what you've learned as a parent to help the young men that you're working with?
From my mistakes when I was younger. My father did not complete high school, but he was always a working man. So I always saw that. I always saw the effort, and I didn't relate it to the education until I got to be a young adult when I entered college, and then I dropped out of college. And then I, got into the work world because I thought that that's why I'm going to school, so I can get a good job. Well, I found a good job. You know, I'm making decent money, but then, you know, I saw the glass ceiling. I wasn't getting promoted. And I needed my education. So what I try to stress to our students is the same thing. You're going to school to get your education to further your career or whatever else you want to do. You don't necessarily have to go to college, but you always have to have a plan, you know, whether it's college or whether it's the workforce. So you have to always keep yourself trained and available, especially with the technology out here. You can't be stuck not being able to use a computer now, even to fill out applications.
You're in Chicago, where Barack Obama has roots, spent so much of his time. Do you see his campaign and the attention that people are paying to it helping young Black men and boys have different aspirations for their life?
I do, in a way. It's of course, someone for them to look up to. But as far as the backgrounds, the kids' backgrounds that I work with are different. They're not going to relate to his background. They might say, well, he had everything or things like that. So they're going to, look at him as like, oh, it's great for, black men and boys, you know, as far as someone to look up to, and they're not going to say, wow, you know, I could be president now. You know, I think they know better than that. They're smarter than that.
So if they're not thinking to themselves, I could be president now, regardless of whether or not they want to be president, but mm-hmm. they're not thinking that that's a goal, a reasonable goal, what are they looking to and who are they looking to?
They have to, it has to be somebody that they're in constant contact with. You have to have male leadership within the school system, within the community, so they can look, you know, so those people can be tangible. They're probably never going to meet Barack Obama. They'll always see him on TV or on a T-shirt because we've, you know, infiltrated our streets with his face and his name, which is fabulous for them. But, you know, if we don't have people that they can call on at any given time when they're in trouble or people that they can talk to throughout the day, then they're going to turn to those streets. And the streets are always, you know, they're 24 hours, as we know. So they're going to go to those people on the streets and get that misled guidance.
Do you think that you're making a difference? You're succeeding?
I hope I am. I believe I am. I've had a lot of youth tell me that they started thinking more about college because that's all I talk about, or the things that they want. You know, they can, you know, if they're in grade school, they say, oh, I want this big house like Deion Sanders, you know, because they got the MTV and, you know, they're showing all this stuff on TV that, of course, the kids want. But I'm like, you know, how are you going to get there? You know, Deion went to school, you know, things like that. And they go, oh, okay, I didn't realize that. You know, they just figure that he was just a great athlete and that's what they're going to do, or they're going to rap or sing or whatever, but they always have to have a plan. I told them, I was like, you know, you have to be able to count your own money and look at your, be able to read your own contracts.
Cornelius, thank you so much.
Okay.
Cornelius Ellen is a project coordinator for the Grand Boulevard Federation. It's a community-based organization serving at-risk youth in Chicago. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Time now for our Africa update. This week, more than 40 African leaders call for free, fair, and peaceful elections in Zimbabwe. Plus, we look at Somalia in crisis. For more, we've got Roxanne Lawson. She is Director of Africa Policy for Trans-Africa Forum. Hi, Roxanne.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Let's talk about this runoff election scheduled for next week in Zimbabwe. 40 African leaders signed an open letter calling for Zimbabwe's presidential runoff to be peaceful and fair. We're talking about 18 former presidents or prime ministers, two Nobel laureates, musician Yusu Ndour, who's also an activist, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. This as President Mugabe threatens to go to war if the opposition party wins the runoff. So last week I spoke with Morgan Tsvangirai, the opposition leader, who had this to say about Robert Mugabe.
For me, I think that the first decade of independence, Robert Mugabe was my hero. I think he deteriorated, and I don't know what has made him to transform from a hero to a villain, and now to a real tyrant, and I think it's very unfortunate.
What are you hearing from Zimbabweans about the runoff election and what they expect from it?
I'm hearing exactly, I think, what the African leaders in their recent statement have said quite loudly. Zimbabweans on the ground, civil society, is adamant in wanting a free and fair election at the end of next week. They want the ability to be able to vote. I heard from one of my colleagues there that even if Zimbabweans have to crawl to the ballot boxes, they will be there and they will cast their ballots.
We also spoke with opposition leader Tsvangirai about the violence that some of his supporters have gone through, including some who have died, some who have been beaten. And he spoke about the young people who one person said, I can't wait to get better so I can go vote. Do you think that people who are under physical duress will still put themselves at risk if that's what it takes?
I think they will and they have. I mean, so many members of civil society in Zimbabwe have not left the country. They've decided to stay there to fight. They want to safeguard their democracy. They want to try to create a government that reflects them and their values. And I think that's really important. I think that they are very much taking up the mantle of their parents and grandparents who waged a liberation struggle. And they are resolute also that they are not going to just that a vote for the opposition is not just a vote for a vote against Mugabe, but rather is a vote for something in the future. And that they also will be just as vigilant if the government changes, vigilant in watching their new government and making sure that they actually uphold their values.
What about the reports that Robert Mugabe is calling for war? Should that be taken as grandstanding or a serious threat?
I think there are elements of a serious threat in what Robert Mugabe has said. I think that if you look at the government right now in Zimbabwe, the ZANU-PF government, the way in which they've positioned themselves quite strategically in the last couple of weeks, the removing of international aid workers from rural areas in Zimbabwe not only cuts off food aid to some opposition members, but it also actually takes away international witnesses to any kind of crimes that may happen in those areas. I think that that, as well as the kind of arming of the police, of forcing, I think, younger people in the police and military and older people to vote in a certain way as they did those away ballots last week, all of those things point toward a very strategic and very purposeful stance that actually is the beginning of a quiet warfare.
I want to move on to East Africa. Conditions in Somalia are getting worse. Violence has increased dramatically since a UN peace agreement was signed last week between insurgents and the government. Now, this agreement calls for a 3-month truce and the withdrawal of Ethiopian troops after a sizable force of UN peacekeepers are deployed in Somalia. Do you think that that plan, that truce, is going to work and hold?
Well, I think already it hasn't worked and held. I think part of the problem is, you know, the rampant number of arms that are in Somalia right now in the hands of both government supporting the opposition. And that's really very problematic. And 80% of the arms that are in Somalia have come from the Somali government, the transitional federal government. And many of those arms have come from Ethiopia and from the U.S. via Ethiopia. I think that's shown us that actually this ceasefire may not work. I think also the sticking point is that the need for the African Union to be able to deploy more troops in a currently on the ground. Right now, only about 2,500 troops from Uganda and Rwanda are on the ground in Somalia, and those numbers need to grow exponentially.
Who should be on the ground? I mean, there are some who don't want UN troops. There's the Ethiopians. There's the aid workers. Who should be there, you think?
I think that the AU is right, that AU troops need to be on the ground to help try to restore some of the peace.
That's African Union.
African Union, thank you. I think also the aid workers need to be there. I mean, right now, Somalia may in the next 4 months see an increase of 1 million people who are both displaced and starving. And I think that for those reasons alone, there needs to be created a safety enough for really important international aid organizations to be able to operate on the ground. It's unfortunate that right now those conditions do not exist in Somalia.
The African Union has offered troops in many situations, but it's also been viewed as highly underfunded, and the troops themselves often are at risk. Is there enough of a heft to the African Union's ability to go into places like this and do it relatively safely and relatively well?
I don't think there is right now, unfortunately. I think the international community, despite their promises to both aid and train African Union forces and then to support them materially, have not come through. I think that's part of the problem that we see with crises around the African continent, that goodwill may exist, but the political and financial will does not back it up. I think right now the only kind of troops that could bring any kind of peace to Somalia would be from the African Union. Any other, I think even UN troops actually might be seen, as many people in Somalia, as just an extension of Westerners and global North countries bidding in Somalia. I think the role that the United States government has played in Somalia, both in the last 18 months as well as historically over the last 19 years, has proven that when international troops who come from other parts of the world are in Somalia, it means very bad things for Somalis.
Let's move on to another question of accountability. There's a new report by the Africa Commission. It says the continent faces an aid shortage of $40 billion. That commission was set up in 2005 by then British Prime Minister Tony Blair, and it was an idea that African countries would work to improve democracy. The West would double aid by 2010. And he says some Western countries, Blair this is, are failing to meet their pledges, but he didn't call anyone out by name. Is that strategy of saying, in general, this is not happening, is that going to work?
I think not. I think that these countries actually need to be named so that they have a little bit of shame. I mean, we're very fond, and I'll name some of them, the United States, Canada, France, for example, all of whom have promised large amounts of aid money, who are benefiting from the payment of debt servicing that African countries are doing, who are making actually money off of the poverty of Africans, and yet cannot, despite their goodwill and their press conferences, actually appropriate money to do things like support democratization processes, governance, and troops on the ground on the continent.
We talk a lot about the problems on the continent, but there are also, you know, even in this report, some signs of good things. The number of people living in poverty leveled off after the past few years. Child mortality rates declined. As far as those good things are concerned, what can we point to in terms of programs or approaches that are working?
I think that, you know, a couple of years ago, Thabo Mbeki talked about an African renaissance. I think that's actually really truly happening across the continent. We see civil society all over the continent growing and strengthening with real demands and holding governments accountable. I think all of those things are success stories. I think that unfortunately, internationally, global North countries, countries that are part of, you know, what we consider like kind of the G8 countries, the wealthiest countries in the world, the U.S., Canada, Britain, etc., have not done enough actually to really support goodwill on the continent. I think that there's been a huge success within international debt cancellation movements, which has freed up lots of money on the continent for governments and civil society to be able to support their citizens. And that's actually, I think, part of the reason that things like poverty are leveling off. I think that there's a resurgence in actually between Africa, inter-African investment and development. I think those things should be applauded.
Do you think that who are the economic engines right now besides, say, South Africa, which is, you know, well tied to developed economies?
I think that Nigeria shows itself at times to be an economic engine. I think that they're actually, you know, within the regional groupings, there are really strong, there's workings that's very quite strong. I mean, despite the violence that was in Kenya this January, I think that the East African community that exists between Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, Rwanda, etc., is showing itself to be quite an economic powerhouse for that region and able to bring some stability. I think that across the board, though, what we see is actually a questioning of the economic policies right now that are pervasive around the world. This policy of neoliberalism is being questioned. And so African governments are trying to find an alternative to that because they've seen over the last 20 years the way in which neoliberalism has impoverished their citizens. And so I think that's part of the reason that the yardstick we're using to measure success, as it were, on the continent doesn't quite measure up to Western standards, because they're actually trying to change that yardstick.
Roxanne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Roxanne Lawson is Director of Africa Policy for Trans-Africa Forum. She was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Now on to the world of art and to an exhibit of works from the African diaspora. It's called Flow, and it showcases pieces by 20 artists under the age of 40. The Studio Museum in Harlem is hosting the show. The museum is known for showcasing up-and-coming artists. Within Flow, you'll be able to see many types of work, including five elusive self-portraits by Thierry Fontaine. In these photographs, the artist hides his face with elements including shells, clay, and a shattered mirror. The exhibit also features a video by Grace Indiritu called The Nightingale. It shows the artist wrapping and unwrapping her head with a piece of fabric set to music. Thelma Golden is director and chief curator of the museum. Thelma, how are you?
I'm great, Farai. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the museum. You have done many high-profile exhibits that have helped shape the art world. So how does Flow fit into your vision for the museum?
Our mission is that we present work by artists of African descent locally, nationally, and internationally. And that was a very long way to say that we wanted to embrace the full realm of artwork being made by Black artists in the world today.
Give me a very specific description of a work that you really love or intrigues you.
Well, that's hard, Farai, as a curator. You know, I am intrigued by work generally. That is what gets me up in the morning, the fact that I love looking at artwork. So there are all the artists in this exhibition, and the artworks intrigue me. What I think is more important to me about this exhibition is that it is not just about the individual works that compel me. It really is about a shift in perspective. You know, in my world, many people have been looking east for the last decade, if not more. Asian art, you know, the subcontinent are all really very much in the news, in the art world news. And I think really people have underestimated the amazing work that's being made by artists from the continent of Africa. and really have not been able to understand the breadth of this work. So what intrigues me about this exhibition is how much this generation of artists are really carrying a mantle. They really are the generation that is going to teach the world what 21st century African art looks like.
The kind of exhibits you put together have a long tail. They have a ripple effect that far exceeds the duration of their stay at your museum. So what do you hope the ripple effect will be from this, either in the careers of the artists that you have featured or in the art market itself?
Well, this exhibition was organized by our associate curator, Christine Kim, with our assistant curator, Naomi Beckwith. And I know that what they hope for as curators of the exhibition, working individually with these artists, and I hope for as director of the museum, is that it puts these artists and their work in the center of the contemporary art conversation, that it brings about a sense of what is going on in the minds and in the work of artists of African descent. You know, I hope that these artists find their way into the sort of larger international art circuit, as many of them already have, and that they also begin to be an integrated part of the dialogue when we begin to talk about black art as it exists here in America. You know, that's one of those complicated terms. What is black art? That's the question we're always asking. And by looking at these 20 artists, we have 20 new chapters in that book of defining what black art really is.
Do you think there's a growing market for African artists or artists of the African diaspora? And I, when I use that term in this sense, I'm not speaking of people who, you know, African Americans of the African diaspora broadly, but people who, as in your definition, either are from a certain country or at least have parents from another country that's part of the African diaspora.
Yes, there is, Farai. There is a huge amount of interest in the work of these artists, and their work is beginning to show up, not just in museums, but in the marketplace, in galleries as well. And it's because there is a greater understanding of the fact that there is amazing work being made. And there's also right now in the contemporary art world an interest in the international perspective. So it's why, you know, in the art world, there is so much time and effort and exhibitions being spent defining the world of art.
If you had to look ahead at how people see art, do you think you can also change the ideas that we have of what art looks like?
I think that we can change the idea of what art looks like. I think artists have done that for us over time. You know, until we see a work of art, we often might not consider what that artist has done art. If it's just described to us, when I think of some of the artists whose work compels me, artists like David Hammons or Kara Walker or Lorna Simpson or Glenn Ligon, you know, when I think of these artists, a lot of if I describe what their work is, people might say, well, why is that art? Cut paper on the wall. But when you see it, when you see their vision, when you understand their voice, you really are moved to understand how wide the definition of art is. So I do think that the experience of looking at art really changes for us the way in which we can understand it.
What are you doing besides showing art? What are your goals besides necessarily providing a home for people who produce art and people who view it?
Well, our role at the museum is to present art. Obviously, that's at the core of the mission. But in addition to that, it's to collect art. We have a permanent collection at the Studio Museum, and that's really about the legacy, our legacy. It's about history. It's about hoping that 100 years, 200 years from now, these works will still be able to be viewed by people. But it's also about being in the space of the production of ideas, of providing the physical space in the museum, but also the sort of mental space, the intellectual space, to have people consider culture in a deep way, in an ongoing way, and in an important way.
Well, Thelma, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thelma Golden is director and chief curator of the Studio Museum in Harlem. Their exhibit Flow features 20 contemporary African artists. The show runs through June 29th, and you can see pictures of some of the pieces at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. How much are you willing to spend on a bottle of fine wine? $30, maybe $60? How about more? And how do we know what makes a wine premium? There are nearly 6,000 wineries in the U.S. African Americans own fewer than a dozen. Stephen Sterling is one of those owners, and he's on a quest to educate African Americans about the pleasures of fine wine. Stephen is a co-owner of the family-owned Esterlina Vineyards and Winery and Everett Ridge Vineyards and Winery. He's also the president of the Association of African American Vintners. Welcome, Stephen.
Welcome. Thank you for having the African American Vintners as part of your show today.
Well, give us some examples of some of the fancier places that your wine has been served.
Well, I guess we'd like to start with the top as one of the most well-known dinner places in the United States for those elite few in the White House.
That's we've certainly at the top.
Yes, we've had our wine chosen by the White House twice, most recently just over a week ago.
Now, that must feel incredible, but you also have, obviously a much wider market. How did you get into this business in the first place?
From the roots of a lot of African Americans, my grandfather was a farmer in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and my father and my grandfather were home winemakers, basically. In the old days in the country, you grew your own vegetables to eat. You raised your own cattle or chickens if you enjoyed those things or wanted those things. And if you wanted alcohol, you made your own wine or different alcohols.
It's a far cry from doing this as something that you drink yourself to doing it as the kind of business you have. And it's still a family business, isn't it?
It certainly is. My brother is an emergency room physician, and he's used his chemistry and biology background to make wine for our family, kind of taking it to the next level from my dad and my grandfather. One of my brothers is an attorney, and he has an MBA in small business management. I have an MBA in marketing and sales. So those things added to putting everything together. One of my other brothers manages our vineyards with my father, and together we run our 5 vineyards and 2 wineries.
Give me an example of one of your favorite wines that you make. I mean, I know what I like. I don't know that I can describe it, but I assume you can describe some of your wine. So pick one and describe it for me.
Sure. Our flagship wine is our Pinot Noir from the Anderson Valley. Anderson Valley is certainly one of the premium growing regions for Pinot Noir throughout the country. That's one of the things that great wines come from great vineyards, and that's why this was a natural transition from a farming background for our family. Growing grapes are the backbone of making great wines, and whether wineries purchase their grapes from growers like ourselves or they have their own vineyards where they make the wines. Fortunately, we have both. We have vineyards in great areas, and they make great wines. Our Pinot Noir is really one of the stellar examples of that. Our very first vintage of Pinot Noir in the Anderson Valley won the largest one of the largest wine competitions in the United States. We have Riesling from a property called the Cole Ranch, which is the smallest appellation or growing region in the United States. The property itself is one of the test questions on the sommelier and master sommelier exam. So wine geeks that knows a lot about wines are often stumped by that question, and we happen to own the entire appellation or growing region. So that's a unique thing for our family and for wine connoisseurs in general.
So, despite the effect of a movie like Sideways, most of us are not wine geeks. So how do you get people to understand wine better? I mean, for folks who may go to, and I certainly do, go to Costco or go to the store and just buy a bottle and hope that I pick the right one. How do you get people, especially African Americans, more knowledgeable about what good wine is?
Well, I think it's kind of changing their dining experiences. That's one of the advantages that I think many people that grew up in the European culture experienced. They oftentimes had wine, small amounts of wine, with each meal as they grew up, or certainly at special occasions. African Americans as a culture don't embrace that same experience or pass that on down to their children because it hasn't been something that's part of our culture as much. But just getting people to try more wines and finding out what they like, it's just like food. Maybe when you're young, you enjoy hamburgers, but as you get older, you enjoy steak or lamb or certain cuts of each of these things. You become more and more of a connoisseur of food, and wine is the same way. Certainly, our transition as a country, we've typically been more – beer has been the number one selling alcohol until the last few years, where now wine has taken the forefront as something that's experienced by more and more people. And it's most importantly for us, combined with great food, great food and dining experiences. And as more of our culture gets into more of the artsy and fine wine and fine dining experiences, wine is more of a part of that for all cultures.
Do you ever find people saying to you, okay, it's great that you do this, but your world is so on another planet, and what you do is so ridiculously specialized, I can't even talk to you because I don't know what you're talking about?
Definitely find less and less of that. I think everybody in our the mystique of wine and the exclusivity of wine, those barriers have been broken down to a large degree, and people are less and less afraid to try wine and to have fun with it themselves. They ask questions about some of the technical aspects of it. We're very fortunate as a family, and the other members of the African American Association of Vintners are also from various backgrounds, and they get the same kind of questions that we do.
Well, let me just ask you specifically about the association, because, you know, it's you are a small but obviously powerful group within Vintners. How do you reach out to black wine consumers and try to spread the message about the kind of work you do?
Well, in general, we just simply try to reach out to all wine connoisseurs in general. That's really our target market. We like to have people from all backgrounds really enjoy our wines and learn more about them. We have an event each year at the Copia, which we just held last weekend, coincidentally, that we try to educate people about the opportunities that there are in jobs and in the industry and leisure and fun in the wine industry. Many people start off working either in tasting rooms or they work in a restaurant, maybe as a server, and then they want to know more about wine, so they become a sommelier, or they take classes for wine education, or they become distributors of wine, or they work for distributors for wine for different parts of the country. We had a gentleman who went to Argentina and bought a vineyard and is starting to grow grapes and do it from the farming standpoint. One of the several of the members of our panel were growers, and so simply farmers. So like growing tomatoes or growing roses in your garden, you learn how to cultivate vineyards.
Steve, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having us on your program.
Stephen Sterling is a co-owner of the family-owned Esterlina Vineyards and Winery and Everett Ridge Vineyards and Winery. He's also the president of the Association of African American Vintners, and he joins us from the studios of UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism.
I'm gonna write me a letter, I'm gonna telephone every town I know.
This is Cassandra Wilson from her latest CD, Loverly. The idea here was to take standards from the classic American songbook. Then she fused them with modern sonics, African rhythms, and of course her own unique vocal style. Wilson has been reimagining old standards since high school, except for a brief stint when she worked as an assistant public affairs director at a television station in New Orleans. She told me that her career didn't really take off until the early 1980s, when she found herself in New York looking for yet another TV job.
My husband at the time, Anthony Wilson, was offered a job with his uncle in East Orange, New Jersey. So I had to travel with him. And when we arrived, I tried to get another job in television because I thought that that's what I would be doing. Well, when you go from a place like New Orleans to the number one market in the world, it can be very difficult. And so I had the hardest time finding a job in television, so I decided to start playing music again. So I went out to a lot of jam sessions and met some musicians, and pretty soon I was back into that whole scene.
What does it do to you when you go up on stage? What do you feel like?
It's very exciting. There's a rush. It's a high. I am thinking about, or feeling, rather, the audience. There are great expectations. There's great hope for what we're going to perform for the audience. And there are a lot of feelings, you know, and it's all very joyful.
Let's move to Loverly. This album to me seems very much, it's leisurely as well as loverly. It is an album where you're taking your time with the songs. How did you go about choosing the songs, first of all?
Really, we had no idea of what we were going to do. And the musicians are of such a caliber that you bring them into a situation like that and you can call off, you know, just about any tune. And because they're standards, everyone knows them. And if they don't know them, they really can access them quickly.
I remember every little thing you used to do. I'm so lonely. Every road I walked along with you. No wonder I'm so lonely. The sky was blue, the night was cold, the moon was new, but love was old. And while I'm waiting here, this heart of mine is singing, lover, come back to me.
Some people won't know them as standards, though. I mean, some of you have listeners of all ages and all backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And if someone's coming to some of these songs fresh, they may not know very much about them. What do you do to make your music appealing to both people who don't have a lot of music history and people who have listened to various versions of songs over many years?
Well, I think you have to make it very particular and very specific to the time. And you also have to make it specific to how you feel about the song and what you want to emphasize in the piece. And you can look at the harmonic structure of the song and make some changes there that are going to be interesting or fascinating for the musicians to perform and therefore make it interesting for the audience. I think the whole point is to, you know, it's win-win. If you are happy about the music, then I think the audience picks that up and they feel that and they enjoy it too.
Now on this album you have some percussion. You have a Nigerian percussionist and you have some ways of inserting African percussion into songs. Tell me about your process of working with the percussion to try to shape some new sounds.
It was really great to work with Lekan Babalola. I've known him for over 20 years. He was the one, really, who suggested the use of African rhythmic patterns as the underpinning for most of the songs on Loverly.
Night and stars above that shine so bright, the mystery of their fading light that shines upon our caravan.
And I thought it was interesting, you know, and a great approach, because when you think about jazz, you have to think about what the music was before Broadway. You know, I tried to imagine what the music sounded like in the very beginning. You know, what did the music of Congo Square sound like?
This is so exciting. You are so inviting.
You know, all of these images came and we just work with those drums and work with fashioning the pieces around them.
Of you, beside me here beneath the blue.
The song Caravan, it sounds like you were really having a good time with that one. Tell me about what that was like to record, why you chose it.
Ooh, Caravan is a very exciting piece because it's exotic. You know, you're imagining all of these things that are, you know, that are of the desert. It was nice to give it that twist, you know, to actually imagine the sounds of the drums in the desert and to weave in and out of the music.
Now, you recorded this album at a house in Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
What was the setup? I mean, what was it like to record in a home instead of a studio, and why did you make that choice?
I love to record in homes. I love it because you can change the dynamic much more inside of a home than you can in a studio. Most studios are the same. The musicians, when they enter a studio, have a very strong sense of the control room. You know, that's the place where the engineer has this huge board, and he's pressing buttons, and he's moving things, and it's like, you know, kind of like the Wizard of Oz. You know, he's the guy that's controlling everything. I thought it would be great to perform in a house where the engineer was somewhere far away from the musicians in a room, and you never see the engineer. you can hear him, but you can't see him. And that's the musicians react to that in a different way. And I think they share the music in a more open fashion than they would if they are isolated in booths and they have to communicate through the engineer's apparatus.
I went down to St. James Infirmary, saw my baby lying there. He was stretched out on a long white table, so sweet, so cold, so fair. Let him go, God bless him. Wherever he may be, he can look this whole wide world over, but never find a sweet girl like me.
You have done so many different types of music. You have even done the Monkees, you know. What's coming up next for you? I mean, I don't know if you've already started work on another album or thought about it, but what direction do you think you're headed in next?
I have no idea. I really don't. I'm still very much inside of this project because you don't leave it just because you finish recording it. You have to begin to think about how to create the live performance of it. So that's a whole other dimension. And so you have to live with this music. And I always say that the music always ends up so much broader than what you have on the recording, because the recording represents the beginning. And once you go out on the road and you play it, and of course each night you're going to try to do something different with it. So it just grows and grows and grows until it's time for the next project.
Well, Cassandra Wilson, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
That was singer Cassandra Wilson talking about her latest project, Loverly. She spoke to us from the NPR studios in New York City.
All I want is a room somewhere far away from the cold night air with one enormous...